This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the art worlds and deep into the psychic bowels of the world's most securitized art storage facility. I am Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. It's episode 247. It's part four, and indeed the final chapter with Max Haven. He, the Canadian cultural critic and author of Art After Money, Money After Art. You know why you're here. So excited to share this episode and this closing chapter to our series of conversations. I don't know if this will ever happen again, where I have a series of conversation with somebody on the podcast, but Max, obviously, and his book warranted this occasion, as you will see in this episode, as you will hear. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can check out several images of Le Freeport, which is the storage facility that I will tell you more about in a bit. The images are probably all from their publicity department, because visitors sure aren't taking their own pictures there. A couple images of Max. You can also, at the website, donate to the show. This is our summer fundraiser, by the way. And you can check out our back catalog via the index. You can also check out our contributors to this podcast. So let me start by commending you for staying with this series, with these conversations, because the first episode, the first conversation with Max, which was much more anecdotal and big picture type material, that was the most popular of all the chapters so far. Though we did not, as you may know, as you may recall, get into the book itself. And I know that digging into this material is by no stretch of the imagination, even the radical imagination, light listening. So kudos to you guys for sticking with it and even embracing the challenge of complex thinking, complicated analysis. Max's book, Art After Money, and our conversations have been a way to dig into theory that's actually applicable to our lives as citizens and as artists, as opposed to some theory, a lot of theory, in fact, that the way that I think about it in the past, over the years, which, as you probably have experienced at some point or other, just feels too insular, maybe even too quixotic. No? So in this final chapter today, this episode, we talk about the cryptic conundrum that is Le Freeport, the maximum security art storage facility in Singapore that Max was actually able to visit in person, and his analysis of it spins off into a look at the elite of the world and their structural violence. And we talk about debt in the form of collectives like Debtfare and Strike Debt, which emerged out of Occupy Museums, which, of course, itself emerged out of Occupy Wall Street. And later, Max lays out some of his thinking around the idea of the abolition of art, which actually, believe it or not, makes more sense than you would think. So be sure to listen all the way through so you can hear more about that. There is, I want to just let you know briefly now, there's a bonus episode that is formed from our conversations, mainly about Max's work in progress, a book on revenge, which I'll tell you more about, like I said, on the back end. Stay tuned to hear more about that. And indeed, it wouldn't be an outro without a series of great old news, a.k.a. Weisling, so stay tuned for those. And now, as we join the conversation, I am posing to Max a listener question that he found to be quite a good one. Talk to you more on the back end. What do you / Haven think is the fate of artist collectives as the art world continues to splinter? And how might young artists who don't yet have the social capital to protect each other use collectives to the advantage of all involved? I ask because I have been part of a number of collectives of idealistic young artists, you know, running around New York City doing guerrilla interventions, social actions, and I find it's all fun and games until someone gets a break. As an object maker, for example, I am more likely to get into a good grad school or to sell a big piece than are my social P-word friends. I find things can get awkward really fast when it becomes apparent that some artists in the collective are doing better than others. Or the collective falls apart when some folks go off to graduate school and others are left behind. One more paragraph here. On the one hand, we want to weaponize collectives against this winner-take-all capitalist system. On the other hand, we emerging artists are forced to fight for ourselves first and foremost. My collectives never have had the ability to get each other into a show. If it's best for my career to leave the collective, I don't know. Do I have a duty to tank my own stock for the sake of my friends? Do I tell my prospective MFA program that I'm only coming if you accept my friends too? What exactly do we owe each other? Should we all become martyrs to the ideals of mutual representation? What I'm getting at is the way individualist culture pits artists against each other in pursuit for opportunity and access, even artists with no financial ambitions for their work. Opportunities are limited. At the end of the day, we look out for ourselves. We feel justified in this selfishness because the illusion of meritocracy conditions us to think that, as Haven said, money naturally flows to the right place. The same could be said for the flow of opportunities and institutional attention. So most artists have some cruel optimism in that sense. We know that intangibles like privilege, extroversion, and connections are instrumental in building a career, but we also believe that we will get recognized if we just make excellent work.
I think it's a fantastic set of questions.
Excellent.
And I think, honestly, your listener has really put their finger on the condition that not only all artists in some way are grappling with, or maybe not all, but many sort of socially conscious artists are grappling with. But indeed, I think it's the question that everyone is grappling with right now, which is that, you know, increasingly the form of capitalism we are living in looks like a sinking lifeboat where we're all told to try and get to the drier end. And that's not really a good strategy for anyone, ultimately.
Yeah, right.
It's such a riddle, and I really sympathize with your listener who wrote in about that, because I think I've myself experienced that in the collectives I've been part of, and almost every artist who works in collectives, I think, struggles with the same thing. I guess I don't have any great advice or words of wisdom to offer that. I think that we know on some level that the collective form of working together is an inherently better one than the kind of individualist competitive idiom that we've been sort of steeped in for our whole lives under this system. But also anyone, as your listener points out, anyone who's been part of these collectives knows that when the rubber hits the road and you are a human being and an interdependent body living in a competitive society, it's very difficult for those collectives to sustain themselves. I think I'm not the expert on this, but I would say that there's a lot we can learn from the success of collectives that have thrived for over the long term. And there's a very good book called by a colleague of mine named Stephen Shukaitis, called The Composition of Movements to Come, which I'd recommend. And in that book, he does a number of interesting things. He sort of takes the artist collective as his object of study over the past, 200 years. And one of the things he asks is, well, what makes some of these collectives more successful, and what would success mean? Is that political success in terms of their impact on the art world and on people's ideas? Is that success in terms of people's lives and their ability to work and live together? Is that a type of success that's of what we call a kind of a prefigurative politics, where they're able to embody and practice the kind of dispositions and capacities that they want to see in the world they want to create after the proverbial revolution? So he does that. But the other interesting thing I think he does in that book is he says ultimately that there's something about artists' collectives that are almost like laboratories for the kind of mass politics we'll see 20, 30, even 40 years later. That if you look at the artists' collectives that were active in the 1890s, the sorts of things they're thinking about how to act together and create solidarity and support one another without a necessary direct connection becomes something that becomes much more widely practiced, say, in the 1920s or the 1930s, and on and on. So he has a lot of faith, and I'm very convinced by his arguments that, in fact, even though collectives and artist collectives especially often fail in their stated goal And sometimes that's because their goal is way too ambitious, like we're, you know, going to create an aesthetic shock that's going to destroy capitalist bourgeois spectacle. And sometimes it's simply because artists are human beings, and human beings are difficult animals.
Especially
these collectors
artists
fall apart. But they, yeah, especially artists. But in any case, I think his argument in that book, which I think is really interesting, is that actually all is not lost. The practice of working collectively, both for the individuals involved and for the society if they're apart, have these kind of outcomes that we, that in the moment we can't necessarily predict or foresee.
Well, that's a nice warm up for finally for getting back into the book for one apparently final time, unless somebody pays us to do it beyond that. This. So we're going to finally let you do some reading, because I may have said it kind of clearly. I may have just implied it, but this section about the Freeport Empire is, we would be completely remiss if we didn't talk about. So I'm glad we're, if nothing else, getting to talk about it finally. And because this is one of the places, or this is one of the instances in the book where you actually got to get a firsthand experience, which was, I think you said, with artists, with the art was only about 20% of the time. I thought I would let you take a read. So you want to jump in at that section that we have in our notes?
So, sequestered in the winding roads of an industrial park, next to the airport tarmac, a mere block away from the garrison of the border police, Singapore's Le Freeport stands isolated from its neighbors behind layers of razor wire fences. This is a purpose-built, highly securitized luxury warehouse for the storage of artworks. While dozens of freeports of this nature exist around the world, mostly in Europe, Le Freeport is unique in its size, ambition, and design. With an invitation, you might speak through an intercom to guards and be buzzed through several state-of-the-art security gates before you enter the compound itself to take in the black and red facility. Then you will pass through a battery of checkpoints more rigorous than any airport. You will hand your passport through a two-way drawer to an invisible guard in an office on the other side of the one-way glass. Courteous staff will instruct you to empty your pockets into a small box and place it, along with your bags, in an X-ray machine while you proceed through the cylindrical millimeter wave, or MMW, body scanner. The millions of dollars of state-of-the-art security and the slick chrome, gray, and red modernist style contribute to a feeling of weightless contemporariness, a sort of weaponized neutrality, the aesthetic of financial liquidity itself. Security is only the secondary objective of all this infrastructure. The candid, curious, debonair warden of the hoard explains in January of 2017 as he led me into Le Freeport's massive atrium, enmeshed in a huge, specially commissioned sculpture and surrounded by identical security doors. The designers and architects worked as closely as possible with the world's leading insurance firms to guarantee that the building, mere meters from the tarmac of one of the busiest airports in Asia, presented an almost zero-risk environment. In any case, he joked, were a thief actually be able to breach the state-of-the-art security, where would they go? Singapore is a highly militarized island connected to Malaysia by only two meticulously secured and surveilled bridges, and otherwise surrounded by ocean. The primary reason for the extreme vetting of visitors, my guide confides, is the same reason for the architecture and the massive atrium sculpture. It's a kind of financial theater. It's not only to impress upon wealthy clients that their art treasures are safe in the crypt, but that they are worthy and estimable subjects for owning such objects, worthy of such concern, and for investing in their protection. Like Foucault's Panopticon, this hyper-securitized, infinitely surveilled, dark utopian apparatus not only controls space, it creates subjects. But as per Deleuze's theorization of our shift to a society of control, which I'm associating here with financialization, we should focus instead on the Freeport less as a space of enclosure and more as a density of codes, a node in a network, a place where the spirit or gas of financialized power gathers, concentrates, and circulates. Here, an impossible-to-ascertain number of cultural treasures lie encrypted, from delicate and one-of-a-kind ancient Chinese urns to conceptual artworks printed on a single sheet of A4 paper. We don't know, and we don't want to know what's in the vaults, the warden tells me, a man who himself marvels at the ironies and contradictions of his vocation. His job, he explains, is to offer Le Freeport's clients rooms of various dimensions, depending on need, that are and will forever be 22 degrees centigrade, 55% relative humidity unless otherwise requested, and as close to risk-free as possible. Access to the vaults requires that both the manager of Le Freeport and the client together simultaneously input their secret codes on separate keypads. What those clients choose to encrypt in the Freeport is their private business, with a tiny modicum of state oversight. While technically objects stored in the luxury warehouse exist on Singaporean soil, until they leave the facility by the front door and enter Singapore proper, their owners pay no tax. It is as if they're still sitting on the airport tarmac, to which Le Freeport has special access rights directly from its back gates. Backup generators stand ready in the unlikely event of power disruption, and a waterless fire suppression system will suck out the oxygen from a room and replace it with nitrogen to ensure no damage comes to the art hoard within. The chain of accountability is nebulous, at least. The Swiss company that built the facility has also spun off a management company to operate it, which in turn leases space to clients like Christie's and various other firms specializing in the delicate and secretive world of fine art sales, storage, handling, and restoration. These companies might be hired by a museum or a collector or a gallery or a shell company set up by any of the above to house an artwork. What precisely is inside the crypt is anyone's guess, though we can be reasonably sure that expensive works of art must be held within. The record of ownership, like the owners themselves, could be anywhere in the world. What is certain is that Le Freeport exists in Singapore to take advantage of the quasi-authoritarian capitalist city-state's unique location, close but not too close to China. Its notoriously strict laws, a militarized population of highly educated native English speakers, a transparent system of property law in accordance with neoliberal international treaties, and, most importantly, proximity to booming Asian and especially Chinese art markets. In a very real way, Le Freeport doesn't even exist in Singapore. It's part of an archipelago of non-spaces that Keller Easterling associates with the practices of extra statecraft, zones that at once mobilize the increasingly authoritarian and violent powers of the financialized nation-state, and yet which exist largely for the pleasure and profit of the world's most wealthy and powerful people, partially outside the laws of the nation-state. Le Freeport may exist on Singaporean soil, but so long as the works it encrypts never leave the facility, they are technically considered to be still in transit. It's not simply that in this way the works can avoid paying import duties and taxes, or risking seizure by authorities if their ownership is disputed. It's also that, while the works themselves may literally not move an inch for generations, perhaps even centuries, they remain constantly in motion in the form of global code. Hence, we can understand the Freeport is a kind of architecture of global financialized capitalism that encrypts arts within its walls. As Derrida notes, a crypt is not simply a tomb. A crypt seals in the dead in order that they still might live after a fashion. We build crypts around the dead to impress their value upon the living, to haunt the imagination.
Nice. Thank you very much for reading that. Before I ask you some questions about it, I want to just add, and maybe this is superfluous, but when you read, in this way, the works can avoid paying import duties and taxes or risking seizure by authorities and their ownership is disputed, I had in my notes that I had just heard on an NPR conversation about the art world, an art expert talk about how when artworks get moved from Freeports generally, they typically ignore the paying of any taxes. Maybe Le Freeport in particular is one of the main reasons that these clients choose this place.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you before we figure out where we want to go with this, what was the emotional experience for you visiting this place? I mean, it sounds like a combination of scary, intimidating, bizarre, and, quizzical, if not more.
It sort of felt like being in a B-horror movie. the place I found it, I mean, it was very expensive, and you can sort of tell by the architecture and interior design that it was pricey, but it also felt to me to be extremely tacky. And being in the space, sometimes you just kind of know that, like, I have a middle-class job and a high level of cultural and social capital as a university professor, but I knew I was in a space where I didn't really belong. This was not a space for me. This was part of a kind of world of, as I mentioned in that passage we just read, of sort of extra statecraft for the world's super elite that is highly, highly sanitized, that's about a kind of seamless, frictionless experience where the kind of the world's plutocrats never have to encounter the kind of dirt and grime and friction of real life.
Mm.
And to be in that space, if you're not, if that space hasn't been created for you, is definitely to feel like an outsider. I mean, I would say I had the same feeling as, in some ways, being in some of the world's more like expensive airports.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is the space that's been, you know, every night cleaners come in and restore it to a kind of state of readiness for transit. There was a kind of feeling of a deep feeling of alienation, I think.
Mm.
But that was complicated because I got to speak to the then manager of the Freeport, who was extremely candid, very charming, very inquisitive, someone with not a lot of experience in the art world, who was himself really trying to understand what this facility was and what he was doing there and why people would spend the sort of money that they were spending on art and why they would want to buy art simply to bury it in a vault next to an airport tarmac.
Mm-hmm.
So meeting with him, that made it very interesting, and he was very welcoming and warm.
How much red tape did you need to go through to get in there?
Shockingly little.
Oh, wow.
Shockingly little.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I just emailed him and I said, you know, I'm a university professor. I'd love to come by and see it because I was going to be in Singapore anyway to speak at the art fair there. And they said, yeah, come on by. And, you know, I think I asked the manager when I was sitting down with them, like, well, you know, I'm not asking this for narcissistic reasons, but did you do, like, a background check? Did you, like, wonder who I was? I mean, someone in Singapore has never heard of Lakehead University and Thunder Bay, Canada. And he said, no, I didn't bother because, like, what are you going to do? This is the most secure facility that's probably ever been built almost anywhere in the world. Like, what are you going to do, steal an artwork from a vault you can't open and run to the bridge to
right.
mainland Malaysia? And then
right.
how are you like, it's so absurd. So, you know, I sort of guess it's the same feeling that you would have if you were having a tour of the Death Star in Star Wars. You know, like, what are you going to do?
Nice.
Of course, then again, in, you know, the Star Wars movies, that didn't work out so well for the Empire. But we can always hope for something like that.
Wow, Max, so populist. speaking of populist, I wonder if the tackiness that you described has any connection with a nouveau riche clientele, or is that maybe not a connection?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if this was a Freeport in a different zone at a different time in history, it would be all fake wood paneling and lofty ceilings. I mean, the place would look like a Florentine museum.
Mm-hmm.
And instead it looks like basically some like space station.
Right.
So it is very much for that nouveau riche clientele. And you know, one of the things the manager told me is that a lot of their business there, I mean, a lot of it is just storing art, but also if you're, for instance, a rich, let's say you're a Saudi oil billionaire and you've bought a work of art for $100 million, you'd probably, I mean, there was a bunch of stories recently about people keeping expensive art on their yachts.
Right.
And in other hazardous places. But what you would really do if you cared about the art and, you know, you would, instead of saying, well, everyone come to my yacht and let's look at this new painting that I bought, you would fly everyone to Singapore and you would have a party at the Freeport. And they have these kind of viewing rooms where you can have a party.
Mm.
And so there's a kind of staged neutrality to the space
mm-hmm.
that accommodates the kind of it's sort of a kind of a blank canvas onto which various fantasies and projections can be put.
Mm-hmm.
But this definitely does serve a newer, richer clientele of sort of global billionaires and multimillionaires
mm-hmm. right.
for whom that aesthetic appeals.
And so you describe the manager mm-hmm. as grappling with why people would spend so much money on artworks and then, you know, hide them away. To what extent have you, I know we should clarify that you did write this book now, you know, it's been almost a couple of years, at least in some of the research that you did. It came out in 2018, just last year, but you know, you probably finished it quite a bit before that. So to all just the, all that prefaces, have you largely forgotten about this, or in some ways have you kind of partially been continuing to sort of work out how such a conundrum exists and unfolds?
Recently, I've been writing about the dead zone in a slightly different context for a new book that I'm working on. And I've been thinking about it as a dead zone. And the dead zone, the metaphor of the dead zone are these spaces in oceans that essentially because of an influx of toxic nutrition, usually from agricultural runoff, there's an algae bloom. The algae bloom on the surface of the water sort of blots out the light. And then the things underneath the algae bloom in the sort of aqua system die, and the bacteria eats the dying ecosystem and consumes all the oxygen, and then you end up with a kind of deoxygenated zone in the ocean. So famously, there's a huge one of these at the mouth of the Mississippi near New Orleans, thanks to all the agricultural runoff from the Midwest. I've been thinking about this dead zone as something that appears many times in many different guises throughout our moment of capitalism. So one of them is this is the Freeport, where you have an incredible influx of wealth that ultimately creates a dead zone, you know, this place where nobody could ever see the whole collection at a glance, where, you know, you basically have these works that are encrypted in tombs purely so that they can operate for speculative financial mechanisms, you know, no longer art as a visual thing that you would engage with, but simply as a financial commodity. Another example of a dead zone in the way I'm thinking about it is, you know, a gentrified city where the core and the sort of cultural hub becomes attractive to real estate investors and wealthier people. The influx of that wealth then makes it impossible for the people who actually created the culture and the value in that area to live there anymore, and it saps the space of a kind of vitality, and you end up with a kind of urban dead zone. So that's why I'm thinking about Freeports these days.
And you mentioned the speculative angle or aspect of these collectors and the state of their works in this tomb or this crypt. Do you think that, this is almost more of a statement, I think, than a question, but do you think their ability to separate, distance themselves from these works and to the point where they're just these, you know, ones and zeros or, you know, what have you, sitting locked away in storage, is analogous to maybe wealthy people's distance from reality as well and insensitivity to the sacrifice of art that would otherwise be enjoyed by, you know, people who can't afford it and that kind of line of thinking?
Yep. Yeah, I certainly do. I think that it, again, this world of extra statecraft that Easterling mentions, I think is part of a great global apparatus of unspeakable structural violence that allows the kind of authors and beneficiaries of those violence, you know, sort of global elites or the global capitalist class, as we want to call them, not just to make a huge amount of money, but to largely ignore or unsee the consequences of that activity. So, yeah, I absolutely think there's a kind of moral insulation that it provides as well.
I'm really interested in your use, and I remember reading this as I was rereading some of the book, the use of the word violence. So you have to, I mean, it's kind of like with the radical imagination, you have to think about it in a very metaphorical sense, I guess. But can you just elaborate briefly on how you mean it in this context?
Sure. You know, and I use it all the time, and it's also a word, I'm glad you asked the question, because I do think it needs to be parsed out each time we use it. So, I mean, we're used to thinking about violence as an act of basically physical aggression. But we know from practically any field of inquiry we'd want to take, from, you know, child development psychology to sociology to, you know, even questions of global economics, that violence can be exercised beyond just physical violence. If you allow someone to starve, you're not necessarily hurting them. You're not physically attacking them, but you are, in fact, creating the conditions of their suffering and perhaps their death. And similarly, we know that, you know, there's various forms of emotional abuse and, psychological abuse that have similar, if not in some cases worse, impacts on human development and human beings than an isolated incident of physical assault. Mm. So violence in this sense speaks to all of the different ways that humans sort of cause harm to other humans.
Mm-hmm.
But then we need to add another layer, which is that often that harm and that violence is perpetrated not by a particular individual with, you know, nefarious intentions, but by a system itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I have a person in my basement and I don't feed them for a month, that is obviously a type of violence and confinement and
mm-hmm.
horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But if I, as a society, if we as a society allow someone to starve, that's what we would call a form of structural violence.
Right.
Or if we allow, you know, for instance, we're having a huge debate about this in Canada because we recently, about a week and a half ago, had the release of a report on the epidemic of murdered and missing Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. And we have a huge debate within Canada right now about who should be seen as responsible for this. And the advice of the report was we need to see this incredibly elevated rate of harm that's affecting this particular population as a form of structural violence. That structural violence is tied to a history of colonialism, and the sum effect of that history of colonialism is genocidal. Though it has, it's an attempted genocide, though it hasn't yet, you know, wiped out all of the population. And this has led to a lot of consternation here because people say, well, this is, you know, it doesn't look like, for instance, the Nazi Holocaust or the Rwandan genocide. How can it be a genocide? But understanding structural violence and the way that it works, sometimes not just beyond the intentions of any individual, but through the good intentions of policies that are poorly thought through or based in racism, these forms of structural violence can be devastating.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can, if it's fair to think of structural violence in the context of the Freeport as the concept I was thinking of in mental health is emotional neglect, which you almost sort of cited yourself. It feels like a version of that. It's like people are so distant and to the point of structural violence, or, you know, to the point of just tremendous indifference to sort of anything outside the 0.01% bubble that becomes like this form of emotional neglect or something.
I mean, I think there's something there to that. I would think it maybe would be something closer to a structure of avoidance for the 0.1% themselves. Like,
mm-hmm.
I think that many of them are, you know, we began this conversation talking a little bit about, you know, meritocracy. Like, the 0.01% are not there because they're particularly talented or smart. So some of them are very stupid and just don't really recognize that the rest of the world exists and are insulated from it. I think the ones who are smart on some level realize that their wealth depends on the incredible immiseration and poverty of billions of people.
Wow.
And a lot of the structures that they build are structures of avoidance. So, you know, the Freeport and this our whole archipelago of extra straight craft facilities exist so they never have to actually see the reality that they know is beyond the walls.
That's not a concept that I recall hearing before, that the sum of these 0.01%, to take this particular model, are cognizant of the necessity of, you know, great destruction of, you know, the bottom whatever percent or what have you to maintain their particular level.
Oh, I think it's, I mean, you know, Warren Buffett famously said of, you know, joke that of course there's a class war in America and his class is winning. And, you know, someone like, you know, Peter Thiel, I think he's a sort of billionaire pseudo-intellectual who is quite open about this. I mean, there's a whole range of them who say, like, look, we are living in a planetary emergency that is going to have catastrophic impacts. It's going to lead to incredibly dangerous situation. And those far-seeing among us who have the means need to create either escape valves for ourselves or sort of pressure release valves that will ameliorate the situation. So the, you know, some of them are building these kind of bolt holes in New Zealand to wait out the climate and, you know, apocalypse of climate warfare that they think is coming. And some of them are investing in asteroid mining and the colonization of Mars because they want to get off the planet that they helped ruin.
Right.
So I think there is a whole class of these types who really do understand the dire situation they've helped create, and so I just think that the vast majority of them are not thinking about these kind of apocalyptic scenario solutions. They're just investing in their own ability to avoid the problem that they know is right there.
I think that's a really I think that's a really important distinction, because I think there is a difference between building, you know, those escape hatches that you described and being so indifferent or you know, there's that cognitive dissonance situation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just being for anyone to actually sort of be aware to the degree that we're talking about structural violence or, you know, the structural avoidance that you, the other term that you used, it seems more like weighted in avoidance slash the way that people can play mind games on themselves to avoid the unpleasant things that are going on. My premise, in other words, is that for somebody to actually be that wealthy and to be fully cognizant of how the chain, you know, unfolds below them is a form of sociopathy. Of course, as we were talking about this earlier, I was thinking, well, yeah, there is a high percentage of sociopathy among CEOs. So there you go. Hey guys, before we switch over to the section of our conversation that looks into debt through various collectives, I am just jumping in for a moment to let you know that this is our summer fundraiser episode. Please support the show financially if you can by going to theconversationpod.com/support. That's theconversationpod.com. Then click on support in the middle of the menu at the top of the screen, where you can then donate via PayPal, Venmo, Patreon, or if you prefer check, please email us for the address. And The Conversation thanks you very much. Back to the show. Okay, so debt fair. There's so much here. I don't think I should get to all of it. Let me just kind of try to set this up, and I'll kind of skip ahead. So you write that debts are never amortized, laid to rest, but endlessly refinanced. The derivative encrypts everything, and everything is in the crypt of the derivative. Martin, who is your big influence, Martin's dance is not a melancholic lament. It brims with a strategic optimism. That optimism is based in what Stephen Chukaitis, in his meditation on the fate of political art today, calls the composition of movements to come. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit here. And you write that Chukaitis encourages us to abandon a knee-jerk assessment of activist art on the basis of how well it seems to directly resist, critique, or problematize capitalism. Art, even radical art, is already, in the terms I have proposed here, encrypted with capitalism. Capitalism is already all around it and inside it. Further, imagining that art, no matter how profound or provocative, could substantially challenge or confront capitalism as a system is quite simply cruel optimism, and usually self-serving cruel optimism at that. The only thing that will substantially challenge the system is the recomposition of social life through mass struggle, the fomentation of powerful, resilient movements that not only protest this or that policy or demand this or that government, but that in the fabric of their being both demand and practice different orders of social value, different organizations of sociality. Let's see. And you say these are things I have elsewhere with your colleague Alice Kasnabich, associated with the radical imagination, not simply acts of individual cognitive brilliance, as important as these may be, but collective manifestations of visionary struggle. The radical imagination, I believe, going back to our first conversation. Martin is curious about the way these practices represent a new method for experimenting within the modes of interconnected, encrypted sociality fomented by financialization and the order of the derivative. One particular interesting example is the work of the Ensemble Debt Fair, a project that derived from Occupy Museums, a New York activist ensemble that derived itself from Occupy Wall Street encampment of 2011. As with strike debt, discussed in relation to the work of Cassie Thornton in the last chapter, Occupy Museums emerged fairly naturally from the Occupy movement, in part thanks to the high number of artists and cultural workers present at the encampments. As Yate McKee's insider theorization of these movements elaborates, this was no accident. In the first place, New York City's culture, tourism, and artistic industries are so concentrated and so deeply exploitive that it is unsurprising the occupation of Zuccotti Park near Wall Street in the fall of 2011 saw so many arts and culture workers participating. Further, for reasons explored in detail in Chapter 2, Occupy activists found a convenient local target in the cultural edifices, museums, and galleries that represented a kind of soft underbelly of the city's and the world's financial elites. So before we get into maybe more strike debt and Rolling Jubilee, something related, I was really curious and interested in talking about this one particular work, artist slash, I guess, collective. So this is from one of your, throughout the book, for people who aren't familiar, there are a number of sort of sidebars, if you will, that include an image, a photograph, and then a long paragraph describing a work that somebody's done. And so in this one, it's captioned Thomas Gokey, $49,983, total amount of money rendered in exchange for a Master's of Fine Arts degree to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, pulped into four sheets of paper, 2011. And interestingly, the image is of this guy doing sort of a really high off the ground kind of karate type move, or mixed martial arts, if you prefer, type move. Do you happen to know if that's the artist or what that's about, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, that's the artist.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So he is also, so he was so pumped up by his debt that he went into this giant jump. Okay. So as I'll just go on, as the title of the piece indicates, Gokey obtained the equivalent by approximate weight of the cost of his tuition to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago's MFA program in the form of shredded U.S. currency from the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, which offers this material to customers for a variety of industrial and novelty purposes. The artist, who was also a key protagonist in the Occupy Wall Street offshoot strike debt and one of the driving forces behind its Rolling Jubilee campaign, pulped the shredded currency and created sheets of paper, which he then offered to sell by the square inch to interested clients at a rate proportional to the total cost of the debt. Gokey set himself up to sell fragments of the work at multiple venues, notably the 2011 edition of the controversial Art Festival Art Prize held annually in the Rust Belt city of Grand Rapids, Michigan, where the general public is invited to vote on their favorite works, with the winning artist receiving a princely sum. Even in 2011, the festival has come under strong criticism both for commodifying and spectacularizing fine art, and also because of the political orientation of the DeVos family, whose fortunes funded both the prize and also numerous right-wing and reactionary Christian causes, notably those that sought to limit the rights of queer people and of women of abortion services. Indeed, Betsy DeVos, the mother of the founder of Art Prize, would go on in 2017 to become the Secretary of Education in the Trump cabinet, overseeing a massive new wave of the privatization of public education and, as of the writing of this book, worrying policy changes towards student loans programs. All right, I'm going to take a break and let you jump in finally. And I'll just say, as a possible prompt, that this is, speaking of prophetic, this is quite prophetic in that in art you have a lot more cropping up of people divesting themselves from certain, from participating in certain institutions or events like this. Most notably coming to mind for me right now is the Michael Rakovich or something like, I'm getting his name a little off. Yeah, from the jumping out of the Whitney Biennial because of the one of the big funders of, or one of the Whitney board members being the owner of a company that produces tear gas. So take it wherever you will, Max.
Yeah, and that example, there's a kind of past echo of it in the Stephen Lambert, well-known artist, was a finalist for Art Prize, and then there was a big to-do as he withdrew his work and rejected the prize as a kind of affront to the DeVos family.
Mm.
That was before Betsy DeVos's apotheosis to the Trump cabinet. So,
right.
It's interesting, and I suspect somebody has written this and parsed it out better than I can on the fly. But I think that there is a real link between, on the one hand, the kind of what was framed up in the sort of mid-2000s as this revolutionary thing, an art prize, which was this kind of populist Rust Belt idea. I mean, the DeVos fortune comes from Amway, which is interesting enough, you know, the pyramid scheme. And they're extremely right-wing religious folks. And they sort of sponsored this art prize that said, well, the people should get to choose what good art is. We're sick and tired of the critics and, you know, all of this intellectual highfalutin art. We want to have a festival that we're going to sponsor where the public is going to choose by democratic means. And I think in a weird way, this – and so there was a lot of debate about that. And there's some good that comes out of it. I mean, the art prize – events every year garner a huge number of people, and they offer prizes to artists. And you know, there's something about that that is good in the sense that lots of people see it. But this kind of demotic right wing reactionary populism against the experts, against the elites who tell you what art is good and what art is bad, and this kind of riling up of the mass it's very tame in art prize. But in a weird way, now we recognize the tune that was being played, because it's being played now around the globe under the sort of conductorship of someone like Stephen Bannon, who's, you know, turned this into a kind of a revanchist ideology, which suggests that the answer to kind of technocratic capitalism that we had before is to put in charge a bunch of, you know, thugs and mafiosos who claim to be liberating people through this kind of extremely weaponized form of quote-unquote democracy. And like an art prize, I mean, the criticism that was being made of the art world through art prize in the 2000s when it was established is not an invalid criticism. I mean, there is, as we've discussed in our previous conversation, essentially a form of kind of collusion between the top flight artists, the gallerists, the sort of brand name critics, and a huge number of other institutional people to essentially define what important art now is, to get that book, that art recognized, to get it gallery shows, to inflate the prices, to get it recognized in books and in criticism magazines, blah, 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 blah. So the kind of populist response to that comes from a fairly, you know, genuine reading of the situation, in the same way that many of the forces that have given rise to the far right today in politics is also taking aim at a completely cronyistic capitalist financialized system where global elites who meet at Davos every year in the Swiss Alps and talk about how they're saving the world, but in fact they're all a bunch of crooks, lorded over everyone else. That criticism is indeed valid, but in the case of both Art Prize and the case of the right-wing reactionary politics, the solution that's proposed is terrible. You know, it reminds me always, you know, these times always call up memories of Walter Benjamin, who pointed out that the problem with fascism is that it gives expression to the suffering of the working classes, but does not actually solve that suffering. It simply gives a voice to the kind of terrors that we're feeling. And I think both Art Prize in the realm of art and this reactionary politics, of which DeVos is such a big funder in part, are sort of part of the same, cut from the same cloth.
Wow. Getting back to the book and Strike Debt, you wrote, during and in the wake of the collapse and repression of its central spatial occupation, Occupy Wall Street awakened a diaspora of activist initiatives, including Strike Debt and Occupy Museums. The former, also disproportionately, though certainly not entirely, made up of precariously employed culture workers, developed an inspirational set of tactics for reimagining debt, a condition common to many artists who had graduated from prestigious but expensive American art colleges, yet who found themselves desperately competing for a living in a vastly oversaturated art market. Indeed, a contemporary art market whose agents and intermediaries thrived on the glut of hopeful would-be artists flowing into the metropole. And that sentiment is one that we will, you know, we will never outlive in the near future. Strike Debt initially sought to organize a mass coordinated nationwide debtor strike, though this proved difficult to orchestrate for a number of reasons. They also produced a collectively authored and edited Debt Resistors Operations Manual, offering not only advice to debtors as how to confront their oppression by the financialized system, but also an accessible historical and theoretical overview of the system. The group's most successful and charismatic campaign, the Rolling Jubilee, drew on the interventionist artistic sensibilities of many of its key protagonists to orchestrate a spectacular maneuver where debtors and their allies would raise money to buy up and then forgive medical debt on secondary debt markets. Let's see. Can I get you to just... So on page 204, you talk about debt bearers seeking to spectacularize their decryption, but I wonder if maybe before I read that, if you wouldn't mind just giving a quick introduction to debt fair.
Sure. Well, debt fair was an outgrowth of one of those diaspora of groups that came out of Occupy Wall Street called Occupy Museums and Arts and Culture Working Group of Occupy Wall Street. And they were working in tandem with the group that you read about a second ago, Strike Debt, which was also an offshoot of Occupy Wall
Right.
Street. And the idea was to try and think through how to expose debt and confront debt through art, and also expose and confront debt as it operated within the art world itself. So it operated around a collective of artists. And eventually what they tried a number of different techniques, but eventually what they kind of arrived at was this technique of doing a kind of open, when they would have an exhibition, they would do a kind of open call for any artist anywhere to submit their work, usually online. And answer a sort of questionnaire, and the questionnaire would be gauged to be about their debts. And what Debt Fair would do is they would display these works, either the physical works themselves or digital representations of the works, not based on any aesthetic criteria or art historical criteria, but simply based on whom the artists owed their debt to. So, for instance, Navient, which is one of the big student loan sort of clearinghouses in the United States, you would organize a whole show of debtors to Navient. And the idea would be to expose the fact that all of these people share this condition, and also to try and create some sort of solidarity between the artists themselves, to say we all share a condition of precariousness and indebtedness to this exploitative institution, and then also to have the audience kind of engage with that solidarity action as well.
Great. Thank you. So I think I really did want to get to this debt fair and winning biennial and so on section, because it does lead up to sort of one of your concluding paragraphs, even though it's before the book. You have a whole epilogue and about cryptocurrency and so on, and then you conclude the book. But I do feel like this is sort of one of the closing sentiments. And so I'm just going to read through from page 204. Debt fair seeks to spectacularize their decryption of the role of debt in art. Debt is both the container within which art is made and also inside and animating the artworks themselves. But debt fair's ambition here goes beyond mere spectacle. The charismatic conceptual acuity and activist flair of the gesture is the passport that in fact allows debt fair to gain invitations to participate in hegemonic art spaces. It is precisely their mobilization of the activist vernacular and sensibility that affords the work the kind of critical crypticness that maximizes its contemporaneity, making it paradoxically deeply attractive to the very same art institutions it seeks to criticize, institutions funded by and with access to the financiers who are the masters of debt in the first place. For instance, in 2017, Debt Fair was given pride of place at the Whitney Biennial, among the most prestigious shows in New York, which is tasked with capturing and displaying the moment of contemporary American art every 2 years. And as I was reading that a second time, I thought you were going to say displaying the moment of contemporaneity, which you had just written about earlier. Debt Fair took the opportunity to target their show at major Whitney contributor Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, the world's largest asset management company, revealing in their characteristic Within the Walls way, the works of artists who owe debt to some of BlackRock's subsidiaries. Debt Fair named Fink as a key source from whom their woes derived. Ultimately, the state allowed Debt Fair to construct a website where they could tally the outstanding debt represented by all the artists, learn about the reasons why the debts were incurred, track the personal effects of the debt on the debtor artists, and, most importantly, begin to sift and sort debtor artists by creditor and geographic location. Visitors to the biennial were also encouraged to fill in the survey, you kind of alluded to this, leading to, by the close of the show, tens of thousands of unique entries. Here, Debt Fair might be seen to be creating a subversive medium or technology for the reverse decryption and re-encryption of sociality though in a very rudimentary, prototypical, and aestheticized way when compared to the massively powerful algorithmic data mining that today underscores the behemoths of the financial economy, like BlackRock and the companies in which it invests. Art becomes the catalyst for debtors themselves to begin a process of deriving new insights into their latent sociality, to decrypt with their own connections and shared conditions, to discover what is common among them. What differentiates Debtfair from the debt collective, which in many ways has a similar approach, is that one of Debtfair's priorities is to create a correlated visual archive of this derivative sociality. When applicants input their debt and personal data into the database so that they might appear in the Debtfair exhibitions, they also upload a demonstrative artwork either about their debt or created in spite of their debt. The result is a massive image database that, in sum, offers a window into what I have sought to call the encrypted common. I see this quiet collection as in some ways the inverse of the Freeport, the museum of the communization of capital, the art crypt, discussed earlier in this chapter. Both are, no doubt, both derivative and constitutive of financialization. Whereas the Freeport creates a silent, invisible, encrypted museum curated by the force of the market itself, by and for Halcyon agents and beneficiaries, Debtfair opens a prototypical or potential virtual space for those abject agents who are its victims to discover themselves. Now here comes finally the sort of concluding chapter for now. As I noted at the beginning of this section, it is important we not fall prey to the cruel optimism that would generate hyperbolic prognoses about the potentials of experiments like Debtfair. They are unlikely to thrive for all manner of reasons, though I hope they do. Nor should we accept the cruel pessimism that would suggest that, because these initiatives are so contradictory, cryptic, small, unlikely, or in various ways problematic, they can therefore be safely discounted. Rather, as Shukaitis advises, we should be attentive to the way that these initiatives provide opportunities to trace a line of strategic imagination, the way that they function to make the walls of the crypts that enclose them and that are at their cores slightly more visible. In this case, I am interested in the ways these initiatives emerging out of the limits and failures of, yet keeping faith with, the Occupy movement that explicitly targeted financialization reveals some possibilities for organizing what Martin calls a derivative sociality and for making us more aware of the surplus common hidden in plain sight. I don't for a moment believe these initiatives can change the world, but I do think they can help inform our imaginations to grapple with the complexities and terrors of financialization and dream of other, broader, likely more violent methods to defeat it. So I feel like that kind of, it first of all, alludes back to the word violent that we were talking about earlier. And it also is one nice summary that kind of, correct me if I'm wrong, gets to one of the conceits of your book, which is that we as artists have a lot of limitations, especially when we operate in the traditional methods of the art world and the art market. However, when we use our radical imaginations, you know, we can find greater alternative modes of working. And I'll let you jump in and take this where you will. But I did want to also allude to the common, the encrypted common in this particular case. Mm-hmm. But somebody I know is getting very interested in the commons. And and I think, you know, we could have spent a lot more time on them. But maybe in addition to just responding to everything I just read, you could talk a little bit about what you're thinking is currently about the commons.
Sure. Well, yeah, I mean, I think that the example of Debtfair is a really good one because it, in some ways, opens up a horizon for the imagination that wouldn't have been there before. And we are actually beginning to see, in interesting ways, the unlikely paths that this takes. So, I mean, I think it's not unreasonable to say that the announcement within recent months by both Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders that they both have a plan to eliminate student debt, this would have been unthinkable during Occupy Wall Street. And in fact, it was mocked in the media when it was suggested by Occupy Wall Street.
Right.
And it's not just that Occupy Wall Street activists sort of got there and held up signs saying debt is over if you want it, which, you know, is fine. It's also that they created these kind of working models that are obviously like Debtfare in and of itself, or strike debt. The sort of models that they created were not actually going to capsize the American debt system. But they punctured for a moment what the Frankfurt School theorists, especially Marcuse, called the reality principle. The idea that like what we have in this world right here, right now, is all that could ever be, and it completely encloses all that could be. And I think that allowed then a whole range of people to be sort of inspired by this question, well, like, why do we have this debt? Who does this debt serve? Maybe it's not necessary. And that then goes on to influence politicians. It goes on to influence the people who advise politicians, who develop policy. I honestly believe that debt elimination in the United States and elsewhere is inevitable. It will happen. I'm very concerned that it might not happen in the way we think. Mm. And I always point out this example. Like, just for the sake of argument, I mean, I haven't had a chance to really look at the details of it, but the Bernie Sanders plan to eliminate student debt seems very sensible and quite wise. I think there's a bunch of other debts we should eliminate while we're at it, but I think it's not so objectionable. I could imagine a situation where a far-right reactionary politician says, we're going to cancel the outstanding consumer debt and even mortgage debt of Americans who own single-family homes who have never been to prison, whose adults have never been to prison.
Mm-hmm.
And instantly you would have essentially one of the most massive racialized wealth transfers in recent American history. So there's a way that the right can weaponize debt forgiveness as well, and I think it's on the horizon. So that's my kind of proviso. And just to break that down briefly, if the American government were to say single-family homes, the vast majority of people who own single-family homes are people who are the beneficiaries of the various privileges we associate with whiteness. The indexing of racialization towards incarceration would also mean that a huge number of Black and Latino and other racialized homeowners would then be sort of eliminated from the pool of people for whom debt forgiveness could be forgiven. But in the great American tradition, race is erased from the discussion, even though it's what would underscore it.
Mm.
So I don't want to say that vision of the future too loudly in case some enemy is listening and thinks it's a good idea. But I think what it reveals ultimately is that you sort of struggle in the wilderness and you work in the field of the radical imagination for a long time and it feels like it's never going to catch. And then it catches like a wildfire that you can't necessarily anticipate.
And I'm sorry. I was just going to underscore your calling out Occupy Wall Street as, you know, the way I think of it is it was this, this amazing kind of revolution for a little bit. And then it became kind of this punchline for the media for a while, you know, and then it kind of went away. But in fact, the fire that it lit, you know, the pilot light that it set up has been burning ever since, it sounds like, based on your description.
I think so. And I think it was very influential for a whole generation of people who have now moved away from Occupy-style organizing and into much more traditional, oddly traditional forms of political organizing, that is to say, and, you know, political parties, both mainstream political parties and radical political parties, in terms of sort of more sustainable groups. So I think it was a sort of watershed moment.
Mm. And you had something you were going to say. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was going to tie it to the question of the commons.
Good.
And you know, in a way through a contradiction, because I think one of the things that a number of us observed during the Occupy movement when we were aligned with it or speaking at various Occupy encampments was that what the Occupy movement was doing in its actuality and actually occupying space and figuring out how people could live together was experimenting or reclaiming a tradition of the commons. And just to go back for a moment, the commons comes from the old English designation for lands held in common. They would be under the aristocratic stewardship of some sort of noble. But essentially, they were lands that the peasants would work together in common, and they would create forms of governance to make sure that, contrary to the mythology of the tragedy of the commons, which is a completely bogus concept, it turns out, there would be a management of a sustainable way of sharing this land for grazing animals and growing food. But it was sort of the lands that the commoners used together to sustain their life. And this has been adapted by theorists like George Kafensis and Sylvia Federici, Massimo De Angelis, David Bollier, and others to kind of describe a methodology for social organization that is neither the market, the capitalist market, but also not just the state. So not organizing things by ownership, but also not just having some sort of large state bureaucratic apparatus come in and manage things for you. The commons instead speaks to sort of self-collective governance through active participation of all those who share access to a space or a resource that in turn sustains them. So the Occupy movement was doing that in its actual instantiations. It was experimenting with new methods of cooperation, new methods of communication, new methods of sharing, new methods of taking care of one another. So really reproducing social life in a different way based on these sort of commons principles. And when the encampments dispersed or when they were destroyed by sort of the forces of the state or what have you, many people who were involved in those movements went on to start other movements, as we've just been discussing. Mm-hmm. And many of them also in the sort of intervening decade or so have moved into kind of more established politics, like, you know, established NGOs, unions, political parties. And my concern is that though the spirit and the activism of the commons that was exhibited during the occupations had its limits, it was also extremely important in the ways that I think we were discussing earlier in our conversation today, in the sense that societies change not from the top down, but from the bottom up. And people need to develop new types of relationships, whether it's in artistic collectives, political collectives, in their neighborhoods, in order to build the foundation for a kind of change that might come through elected means. So if, for instance, people are excited about the policies that are being put forward by a particular presidential candidate, that those policies, as we discussed, are not going to be able to be implemented unless there is a massive social upheaval to push them forward. And in turn, that social upheaval won't just come out of the way that we live today. You know, just to give you a very practical example, it's almost impossible to develop a kind of social movement of people who live scattered out in suburbs because they all have to drive into a central place, right? So there needs to be a sort of shift in the way that people live their life. There needs to be a shift in the way that we relate to one another, we provide for one another. You know, as long as everyone's just an isolated individual, these movements are not necessarily going to be successful, just, you know, going every 4 years to cast your vote. And here I'll close by just tying it into art. Mm-hmm. I think one view of art that sees the artist and the story of art as the triumph and the necessity of that isolated individual, even if the person who's sitting alone in the suburb watching the news and never really participates in society doesn't see themselves as an artist, they still see themselves as the inheritor of a legacy of Enlightenment, capitalist modernism, and colonial modernism that sees the ideal actor in society as the individualized agent, whether that individualized agent is a voter, whether there is an active shooter, whether they're an internet troll. It's all about the individual actualizing their will on the world. The perspective from the commons, I think, is another trend that can come out of the history of art, which is to say that throughout the history of this thing we call art, there have been collectives, artists experimenting not only with new forms of representation and expression, but new forms of working together, new forms of building collective care, new forms of sharing ideas, even sometimes when those sharing of ideas is rivalrous and conflictatory. And there's another history there. And it's a shame when in something like Art Prize, to go back to that example we used before, this image of the artist as the isolated genius who competes against everyone else to actualize their will in the world gets reproduced, when there's so many other things that could be reproduced in the stories we tell about art and artists.
And I think that's a good segue to draw us back to the beginning of the conversation, you know, the listener's question about the competitive element, you know, and it seems like you're articulating the, you know, and did so to some extent in the book, the competitive element of the art world, the art market, what have you, versus, you know, these more collective, radical imagination based, whether it's collective or individual, but, you know, it's certainly not competition based, I guess.
I think so. I mean, I think my thinking is changing or adapting a little bit on this question, because I don't think we're ever necessarily going to overcome competitiveness. I think that's that's a part of our being, and I think it's not a bad one. It's just the problem when you organize a society around competitiveness,
mm-hmm.
When probably cooperation and care and thoughtfulness are actually more universal than competitiveness, and certainly stronger in the way that people live together.
Mm-hmm.
So I, on one level, I think that there is some space for thinking, well, you know, the most exciting art that has come out has been the product not only of collaboration, but of rivalries and competition and the kind of effervescent cultural climate that comes when many people are working on similar ideas at once. And that's not necessarily to be, you know, bemoaned. I would want that in any sort of society. It's really a question of how we can create a society where everyone can be taken care of and everyone can contribute. And then within that sort of society, then find the place for competition that allows it to be socially useful and socially productive rather than socially destructive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this is something that a lot of artist collectives are kind of experimenting with. But, you know, like every experiment, it's you fail a lot before you get
it
right.
Yeah. Do you have any, I mean, I think you've kind of addressed it to some extent, but having completed this book some time ago and moved on to other projects, looking back on it, you know, and maybe as a summary to our four conversations, has anything kind of re-arisen or has your perspective given you any new insights or perspective?
I don't think so. I feel like I don't have enough distance from it yet, even though I'm working on other projects in a strange way. I mean, mm-hmm. these conversations have been very helpful for that. So thank you. It does help me kind of think about it in a different light.
Okay.
I mean, I think and in the book I make a call for the abolition of art at mm-hmm. the end. And I mean that partly in echoing a long-standing avant-garde call for the destruction of the line between art and life. But I also take that notion of abolition from contemporary abolitionist politics, which focus on the prison. And the basic idea of prison abolitionist thinking and activism, to which I'm quite committed also myself,
mm-hmm.
Is if we wanted to have a society where there were no prisons, what would we have to put in place starting today to make that a reality? So if we don't want to use prisons to punish people, if we don't want to use prisons to keep the population safe, quote unquote, which, you know, prisons don't keep people safe, statistically speaking,
right.
It's a complete misnomer.
Mm-hmm.
But if we wanted to replace the prison with something else, how would we start building those institutions now? And how would we remove the funding and power of the prison within our society? And I sort of end up asking the same question about art. If I come to the conclusion of the book, if art, as we have known it throughout capitalist colonial modernity, has always in some sense been a tool of power, but has also met certain social needs, the need for expression, the need for creativity, and the need for the radical imagination, how else could we meet those needs?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Through what other institutions? Mm-hmm. Which isn't to say everyone should stop painting or making sculptures or making film or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but it is to say if we were going to abandon or set aside the category of art as we understand it and instead categorize those activities differently and name them differently, what would that have to look like? And I think that's the question that continues to fascinate me. And I think throughout the book, I name a number of moments where artists essentially step out of art or step beside art to do forms of activism or forms of community care or experiments with collectives that at first don't appear to be artistic and yet couldn't have come from anywhere other than the arts as
mm-hmm.
we understand them.
Mm-hmm.
So that question, I think, continues to perplex me. Because with prisons, it's much easier to see. I mean, not easy, certainly isn't easy to see, but you can understand when you pose that question, if not prisons, then what? It awakens the imagination in a certain way. When you ask that question about art, if not art, then what? If we were to abolish for the moment all the museums, all the galleries, all the freeports, all of the infrastructure that's built up around art and allowed creativity to settle into a new form, that seems like a much more abstract question. But I think it's one that is being experimented with in a whole variety of ways, and it's quite exciting as well.
Huh. What comes to mind when you say that in particular?
Well, And here's maybe where I'm, to come back to your question just a moment ago, where I meet a certain contradiction. I think the first place my imagination goes is to the way in which creativity expresses itself in social struggle. So I think about the sort of creativity and imagination, the kind of things that we usually put in the box we call art, that kind of got let out of that Pandora's box during Occupy Wall Street or during other movements, where people find each other in the streets, and there's an incredible effervescence of creativity and imagination and out-of-the-box thinking that, instead of being put on a canvas, becomes a sort of experimental substance for the recreation of social life together. And to a certain extent, I still think that's true. And I think the problem that we face in our society is that that kind of creativity and imagination gets encrypted in this thing we call art.
Mm.
And then only given to certain people we imagine to be gifted. So we say, oh, that's art, and it's just for artists.
Right.
And that's an incredible thing, a terrible thing we do to society, because it means that the vast majority of humanity will never have an opportunity to have their creativity and imagination expressed or honored. The contradiction for me is that I want to say to that observation, which is at the core of my book, yes, and some people have incredible gifts that they deserve to be able to share with humanity, and they're going to need the time and space and latitude to do that. And we need some sort of institution that can recognize the difference between an important, meaningful, mediocre work and something that truly takes our breath away. And unfortunately, as much as I try and get away from that method of thinking, there's still part of me that thinks somehow it's never going to quite work to simply dissolve all of art into life, as the avant-gardes of history have pointed to. Mm-hmm. And the abolition of art, after the abolition of art as we know it, there still must be some way of honoring the triumph of human capacity to create and imagine that will need to be built. I don't know what that looks like, and I don't know how to bring that honoring of the triumph of the human imagination and creativity into dialogue in a different way with the honoring of the creativity and imagination that is inherent not only in all humans, but specifically in all humans as we work together with one another and work together with the rest of creation, you know, plants, animals, mm-hmm. other species, other forces that work in the world. So that's the thing that I can't quite square.
Right.
I don't think it's like a massive crisis. I don't think it undoes the,
sure.
the points made in the book, but it's an interesting conundrum to think through.
And that conundrum and that thinking exercise or process is for me, and the way we talked about the radical imagination towards the beginning of our series is for my takeaway is this, if nothing else, this is a way to relook at what we're doing and see things from a new perspective, and ultimately to try to sort of push our thinking, way beyond the box and the, you know, the status quo that is just so easy to fall into for artists, among other people.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And, you know, we are like those billionaires we talked about before. We all build structures of avoidance. Because the state of things
right.
and our access to understanding the state of things today is sublime. you know, we are being essentially forced to watch what appears, and I hope I'm wrong about this, but essentially we're being forced to watch within our lifetimes our own species make our habitat uninhabitable for
right.
most of us
right.
and with great human costs.
Mm-hmm.
So I think all of us on a certain level have to develop certain a certain kind of psychosocial infrastructure of avoidance to not have to face that. And I think that expresses itself within artists in the art world when thinking about what is the role of art and what can art do today. Because if you think about that question too much, you can get to a very dark place.
Yeah. That is a perfect sentiment to end on, Max. Thank you so much. It's been a great run, and I'm honored to have you all this time.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine.
Oh, thank you very much. And if we meet again through a future book, but if not, your legacy will certainly live on from at least a couple of the people you've written about on this show. Thank you.
Well, that's been the great pleasure of writing. It has been meeting and talking with all the artists and then being able to have conversations like this with you. And thank you for both interviewing me and this wonderful opportunity, but also for all the work you do in helping artists and people who care about art and the imagination and creativity explore these ideas and generate a better dialogue.
Thank you so much. I appreciate those words a lot. All right. And we're out. Many thanks again to Max. It was great having you on the show. Hope you got as much out of it as we did. And feel free to thank Max yourself. His website is simply Max Haven. That's HAIVEN.com. And if you go to maxhaven.com/about, you've got all of his contact information down there at the bottom. And in just a moment, I'm going to tell you more about the bonus episode featuring Max's next book on revenge. I'm also going to share an encouraging listener comment about this series, particularly the early part that you may identify with. And we will follow that up with the Weiss links. But first, a big thank you, as always, to producer Andy Davis for providing us with the smooth edits for this episode. Thank you also to producer Sarah Suarez for her numerous contributions to the show. And now here is that comment. So an anonymous listener, a listener who preferred not to be identified, wrote this: as an artist oriented towards the beautiful object, I found your conversations with Max Haven wonderful and surprisingly reassuring when he talked about how artists artificially steering their work towards politics generally results in bad art. In parentheses, that's been my working theory. And that you can be a socially active and effective person without your work having to be overt. And then parenthetically, and possibly you just might do more good that way. Crazy thought. I was sort of scared going into your podcast that I'd come away feeling crappy and out of it, but it's actually been the opposite. So thank you, listener, and you know, if you are anywhere near that sentiment, do let us know as well. We would love to hear from you. All right. So if you are interested in this newest bonus episode in which Max talks about his next book about revenge, among other things, and it is called from two of our separate conversations over these four, the conversation ranges all the way from incels or involuntary celibates and pickup artists all the way to palm oil and its complicated history related to the Empire of Benin. So if you can make a one-time donation of $25 or more, I will send you this new bonus episode. And hey, if you can donate $35 or more, you might as well go up another $10. You will get all 9 bonus episodes, including this new one with Max. And if you want it, a bumper sticker, the P word bumper sticker or the conversation logo bumper sticker, do let me know and I will get one of those to you. And of course, the bonus episode or episodes, depending on how much you donate. Again, summer fundraiser episode, anything you can do to support the show financially is very much appreciated and it really does keep the show going. Of course, you can support the show by following us on social media at Artist Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. Thank you very much in advance. Let's move on finally to the week's old news, a.k.a. Weiss links, as always, selected by Megan Bickle. Thank you, Megan. Another on-target comment by Alan Schwartzman. Just ask Gatsby. Infected by money to the core. And there's a little emoji that's very frustrated looking. Quote, yes, we know that museums do more and more programming that reinforces the consensus of the market. That's where their money comes from. And in reply, I wonder if this is principally an American phenomenon of culture having become such big business that everything has become commodified. Perhaps the radical doesn't live here anymore. Alain Servais. Top museum directors decry the soaring cost of popularity. Top museum directors gathered at the Prado in Madrid to discuss the challenges facing big museums, including the rising cost of blockbuster shows and overcrowded galleries. Eike Schmidt, the outgoing director of the Uffizi in Florence, doesn't think blockbuster exhibitions should tour the world like, quote, rock stars. Philip DeMont, the director of the Stadel in Frankfurt, revealed that it will cost around $95,000 to insure a single painting by Van Gogh. That's from ArtNet. And finally, this is from the Independent UK. Russian teacher kills friend. A Russian teacher allegedly killed a friend in a drunken argument over literary genres, investigators have said. The pair engaged in an animated discussion of the merits of poetry over prose during a drinking session, which soon escalated into a lethal brawl after the suspect stabbed his friend, insisting that poetry was superior. In a statement, federal police in the Russian region of Sverdlovsk said, "The host insisted that real literature is prose, while his guest, a former teacher, argued for poetry." The literary dispute soon grew into a banal conflict, on the basis of which the 53-year-old admirer of poetry killed his opponent with the help of a knife. The incident comes 4 months after a similar argument over the theories of German philosopher Immanuel Kant, who argued that reason is the source of morality, resulted in a man being shot in a grocery store in southern Russia. Again, that's from the Independent UK. Indeed, a rather dark place to end, but slightly uplifting and humorous at the same time. Perhaps, one could say. All right, guys, thank you very much for sticking it out for all 4 chapters of Max Haven, Art After Money. Let us know what you think. Thank you very much again for listening, and I will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Happy summer, and ciao for now.